Good evening. So my name is Stephanie Casatley, and I'm delighted tonight to introduce our speaker. What I'd like to do just briefly is tell you how I met our wonderful speaker. About 2 years ago, a dear friend of mine, and also Andre DeBusse's, named Diane, invited my husband and me to their home for dinner in up here, not too far away, and we were happy to tag along. And when we first pulled into the property, which was deeply wooded in Newburyport, I'm not from here, I started to get a glimpse of who Andre DeBusse was. And as we pulled into the property, this beautiful house emerged, very rustic. I wouldn't call it a cabin, but it's pretty rustic. And I soon found out that this three-story home, you know, maybe, I don't know how many thousands of square feet, he built with his own two hands. It took him 3 years to build it. His brother designed it. Family and friends chipped in and helped construct it. And he and his wife shingled the entire roof. So this home was, you know, really sort of a mile. And then when I stepped into the home and saw thousands of books surrounding me and artifacts and art on the walls, you know, this feeling of a monument sort of formed even bigger in my mind. And as the evening progressed, I learned more about, you know, his background and his family and his how he grew up. And, you know, from modest means, and I don't know if I would say poor, but he came from a modest background. And he had a variety of different careers along the way before he became a successful writer. He was a boxing, he had his golden boxing gloves. What else did he do? He was a carpenter, he was a private investigator, he was a bounty hunter. People live this many lives, but he did all these things, not necessarily in that order, till eventually he you know, really became successful as a writer and also still a teacher. So what I have to say about Andre is that his home sort of represents, I think, much about him. And that is that his life has been about hard work, a lot of twists and turns. His love of literature, his deep commitment to family, his exceptional talent for writing, storytelling, and bringing difficult things to life. And his most recent book addresses that. All of his books, I think, address that. And one of the things that I read that Andre said, which really resonates with me, is that building a house, they're quite similar. You do a little something every single day, and then again tomorrow, and then one day you look up and you've got something. Andre's seven books include the New York Times bestseller House of Sand and Fog, which many of us know about. If you haven't seen the movie, it's also well worth watching. He wrote The Garden of Last Days, which, by the way, was the book he was writing when he was building his house concurrently. His memoir, Townie. His most recent novel, Gone So Long, has received starred reviews from Publishers Weekly and Library Journal Books of 2018 and the top 100 Amazon. He's been a finalist for the National Book Award. He's been awarded the Guggenheim Fellowship, the National Magazine Award for Fiction, two Pushcart Prizes, and he's a recipient of the American Academy of Arts and Literature. His books are published in over 25 languages, and he teaches full-time at the University of Massachusetts Lowell.
Lovely to see you all. It looks like a lovely 11 and a half minutes. And then let's have a conversation, if you'd like. That's my favorite part of getting up in front of people. I love that conversation time. I think what I'd like to talk about tonight is the imagination, which every child gets. Every child gets one. You know, my brother is an artistic genius. He has an imagination. We're just normal. And the reason I share that with you is I think the far too adults, right up into their 70s and 80s and 90s, if they're lucky enough to live so long, have have a similar thought about themselves. Oh, I don't have the imagination. It's my poet sister or my pianist father or my painter uncle. But one of my favorite things, one of my favorite definitions of art, you know, you can get a PhD wrestling with the hell art is. You know, I've had long fights about it myself. Like, that's not art. Are you kidding me? That's crap. But Tolstoy said, art is transferring feeling from one heart to another. Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that beautiful? Art is transferring feeling from one heart to another. And I would submit to you, there's only one thing that's going to do that. It has to be present in the work, whether the work is a novel or a memoir or a dance or a film or a painting. And that's truth. Not the big ones, but the small ones, right? It's one of the central joys of being a reader. You know, if I can capture what it might be like to wake up hungover under a bridge in 1943 after having not got on the troop ship to go to Europe, maybe I'll say something about America. But first, let's concentrate on the smell of urine under the bridge, the broken glass, the taste of old gin in my mouth. My name's Tony. I'm making this up, and I think I like it. Gustave Flaubert, the great Flaubert, said, you know, what the public doesn't understand, he said many years ago, is that it is not the writer who chooses the subject, it's the subject that chooses the writer. Always seems to go better when I let go. It always seems to go better creatively, not when I set out to say something, but when I set out to find something. Not when I set out to tell a story, but when I set out to discover it. And by the way, when I look at whatever I've put out in the world over the years in terms of writing, I think it's a fair number, 5% of it, are the phoenixes that rose from the ashes of what I wanted to write about, and then something else showed up that I didn't even want to write. I'll give you two concrete examples. Three, quickly. One, for years I was interested in a certain kind of con man I'd read about in the newspaper. You know, one of these bastards who really cons women out of their money. Not a sexual predator, but a financial predator. And although, actually, probably they go hand in hand in that scenario. And I was really interested in that kind of a con man twice to write a novel from the point of view of the con man. I did all sorts of research on financial fraud and identity theft and all the, you know, all the research I had to do. And then I'm writing from his point of view for like 6-8 weeks. I think, wow, this is my next novel. It's going to be a sexy con man novel. Oh, this is cool. Except, I have to say, Hemingway has this great line, every writer needs a built-in shockproof bullshit detector. For days, weeks, I'd show up at the desk and the detector would go off. So, no, it's fine, shut up, you're fine, it's fine. There's nothing wrong with this, this is interesting. So now I've established his character, I've got 60 or so pages and now or less, and now I'm gonna go to the point of view of his first victim. And, you know, I don't plan these things out. She just showed up. And let me back up. 35 years earlier, do you want to sit down? That chair was mine, and I'm not sitting there. Go ahead. Have a seat right there. So 35 years earlier, my sister's working at a bank in Miami. We're in our 20s. It's the 80s in Miami, so it's like cocaine dust in the palm fronds, and Don Johnson's driving by with no socks, and... And I'm just like 110 degrees summertime in Miami, and I'm just running across this asphalt bank parking lot just to go give my older sister a hug and head back home, I think on a bus. And I glance drive-through, you know, little thing. It's Miami, it's very modern, and it's looks like a bullet-shaped glass enclosure with tinted glass, air-conditioned little pod that this one woman is working the drive-through traffic with. She's large, she's pretty, she looked very solitary. I glanced at her for like half a minute. 35 years later, she shows up under my Ticonderoga number 2 pencil as this guy's first victim. So I go to her point of view just to get to know her before I zap her with my sexy con man of writing. She was so much more alive, so much more flesh and blood, three-dimensional, real, than this con man from whom I've been writing for weeks. It took me years of teaching creative writing before I heard myself start to say this. I think there's a difference between making it up and imagining it. And the con man just felt like a facade. Now here's the thing though, and she felt real, but I didn't want to write about her. But when I went back to the con man to zap her, it just felt like such crap. It felt so false and forced and flat, even though the sentences on the surface seemed okay. So I wrote about her. Blaise Pascal said, anything written to please the author is worthless. What? We don't even get to write what we want? I say no. And my editor and publisher were waiting for a novel, but it just turned into a 50-page story about a woman looking for love, couldn't find it, and then when she found it, the real shit hit the fan. Story number one. Story two, I'm working on an essay about my sons. We have three kids. Austin's 27, Ariadne, our daughter's 24, and our youngest son, Elias, is 22. And my sons had a pretty stable, well, they all did, kind of a stable, upper middle class childhood. And when kids get into sports, where if you don't move 14 times as I did when I was a kid, and they play T-ball and then B-ball and then C-ball or whatever, around age 8 or 9, I noticed it got a lot more competitive with these damn youth sports. But with the kids? With whom? No, wasn't the kids. With whom? Who got more? The whack job parents and the coaches. Son would be on the mound. My oldest son, who was good enough to go on to pitch in college if he hadn't gotten hurt, he's on the mound. The opposing pitcher gets on the mound. The kid weighs like 38 pounds. His drill instructor, 250-pound shaved head coach, yells, Danny, nothing but strikes. Kid, I want strikes only. I think, holy God, major leaguers can't throw strikes only. So the following year, you guys, I volunteered coaching to protect my sons from the whack jobs. So that first season, we had moments like this. First season, I learned that the first number in the column is the winning column. The next one's the losing column. I didn't know that. I didn't know the first two fouls were strikes. That didn't seem fair. I learned you don't have to slide into first base. So I thought, okay, I'm going to write my first funny essay. I'm going to write about how my sons brought me to baseball, not my father, because I didn't live with them. And I'm going to maybe humorous essay about the coach who didn't know how to play baseball. 500 pages and 3 years later, I wrote what I was doing instead of playing sports. And that's living with my mom and my siblings, moving 2 to 3 times a year for cheaper rent, getting beat up a lot because I was a small kid who wore glasses and used adverbs in daily speech. That wasn't good. You know, my mother, maybe you grew up this way too. I watched this woman choose between paying for the groceries or putting gas in the car to go to work. Or we're going to put gas in the car to go to work, but I'm going to be late with the heat. Or we're going to get heat, but then we can't get groceries. Or I'm going to do all that, but there's no rent. And I watched this woman juggle that and raise four kids alone. My dad was not a deadbeat dad, but he was a real, it was a 70s divorce. He'd pick us up for 2 hours on a Sunday, take us to a restaurant he couldn't afford, give us a hug and a kiss, and we'd see him the following week. We never spent the night at his house. It's just, it was more how it was done 40 years ago. So I'll end this little tale with this new novel I've got out called Gone So Long. It's such a, may I disrobe?
Yeah.
I wanted nothing to do with writing this book in the same way that I had no intention of writing a memoir. I was trying to write a funny essay. Well, thank you, ever so. I was working on a screenplay. I'm not a screenwriter, and if you are, you're going to know that I'm not a screenwriter when I tell you my first draft for this screenplay was 198 pages, which is like a 7-hour movie. But it came from an essay I wrote for Boston Magazine about a real man doing real time in a mass. I won't go into the whole story, but it's a really, really interesting story about redemption, because he changed in prison, became actually a good man. And then he escaped. Now he's back in prison. He'll never get out. So I'm in a major Midwest in Norfolk in the 60s and 70s. The guy was in his 60s, very lovely man. He was warm. I mean, for me, a litmus test, he was really respectful of the waitress. He was kind, he was attentive, he was interesting and interested. And he gave me 2 hours of fantastic detail for this screenplay project. And I had a whole notebook full of notes. And I felt, you know, the way you do sometimes. I felt like, wow, I think I maybe have a new buddy in this guy. So as I'm paying the bill, I said, hey, man, I know I'm not supposed to ask, but why'd you do 15 years? Oh, I stabbed my wife to death. And I couldn't swallow. I won't go into my youth too much, but one of the things that I became was a vigilante. I hate injustice. I hate cruelty. I hate the powerful lording over the powerless. I grew up in a town in a time where it was, I don't know how many women I saw punched in the face by boyfriends and husbands. I used to go looking for them once I began to become a fighter, and I used to wail on them and put them in the hospital. A few times I got arrested, a few times I got beat up. It was a dark time in my life, and actually creative writing got me off that path. I share that with you because when this man told me that in that restaurant, it hit all my buttons. I hate men like this. But here's what I want to share with you. I couldn't deny that I still liked him. I couldn't deny that we still had a great 2 hours together. I couldn't deny my feeling for him. And yet I hated what he'd done. And now I just want to get the hell away from him. But it's one of these restaurants where the hallway to the parking lot is like a football field long, and I got to walk all the way down with just him. I just want to go home. And to make conversation, I said, so you have kids? Oh, yeah, but they don't want to see me. And that sentence stayed in my psyche, floated through me for like 2 years. And I wanted nothing to do with it. I wanted nothing to do with it. William Faulkner was asked late in his life, Mr. Faulkner, what's the main thing a young writer needs in order to do what you've done with words, sir? He said, well, it ain't talent. He said, I used to think it was talent, but I don't anymore. And he narrowed it down to one quality of mind. Anybody know what he says? It's a pretty famous answer, one word. He said, this is the thing you need more than talent. Curiosity. And his exact phrase was curiosity, insight, to wonder, to mull and to muse why it is that man does what he does. And if you have that, talent makes no difference whether you've got it or not. How many of you, be honest, have ever tried to fall in love with a particular human being? It's like, that's the one I'm gonna fall in love with. How'd it work out? Did it work out? It did? Oh my God, that never happens. What's your name? What's your name? Monica and what?
Doug.
Monica and Doug. Well, you guys are rare. Most of it doesn't usually work out, right? I tried it once before I met my wife years ago. And it was just, that's the one for me. She's got everything that works for me in every way. And then it came time to kiss. It was like kissing my mother and my sister. yeah, bad. I think she probably may have felt the same way, actually. The reason I bring that up, and there are exceptions, I think in the same way you can't really choose with love. You either do or don't, gay or straight or in between, you fall. I think in the same way we can't choose what we're curious about. We're either curious about a situation or we're not. And I could not get that line out of my head. I couldn't get that situation out of my head. What if you've vowed to cherish this woman till death do you part, to do everything you can to make her life better and safer. And yet you've made this baby out of love. Your problem is not her problem, and she understandably wants nothing to do with you. I resisted it, and then I began to see him in his yard, caning his chair, a chair. He's a chair caner, a skill he learned in prison, and he's looking back. on his life, and he wants to see his daughter, who he has not seen in 40 years. He wants to see her before he dies, and that is one of the first scenes in the book. And if we have time, do we have time for me to read it, or if not, we can just talk? Yes. Do we? Okay. I guess all you need to know, the novel's called Gone So Long, and I'm going to read from really towards the very beginning. Daniel is in his mid-60s. He's very sick. His dad, Liam, was the guy who painted all the rides at all the beach arcades and carnival parks where they lived growing up. Lois and Jerry are Daniel's former in-laws. And I think all else you need to know is that he's looking back on the day that he lost his mom. She died about 3 years earlier. And I'll just read it. A truck passes by. Daniel can't see it over his fence, but he knows from that feathering rattle of the diesel that it's a pickup, one of those big ones kids like to drive now. His mouth and throat are dry. He still punishes himself, he does. But nothing good is going to come from not drinking water when he should. 5 appointments have come and gone without him. This life of his is not something he fears ending. He threw it away with both hands years ago. But these past 34 months, his name has sat inside him like a shard of glass. And for too long, he hated Liam and his mother for not taking her in. They lived in the same neighborhood as Lois and Jerry, and his daughter could have had his old room in the Ahern house, so why didn't they take her in? Though Ma said she'd wanted to, that she begged Liam to do it. She told Daniel this a very long time ago, and she said it again. Those last days, sitting beside his mother's, she turned her head and stared at him. The oxygen tube in her nose hooked around her ears and flattened her hair. I was on the flying horses, Danny, me and your father. I was on a stallion and he was on a mare. Isn't that funny? The Broadway flying horses, Liam's pride, maybe his only one. A carousel of 4 chariots and 46 hand-carved wooden horses, 3 dogs and 3 goats. Some Danish sculptor carved them in 1890, but for years Liam Ahern kept them alive, using a different color of Japanese oil paint for each bridle, mane, saddle, and tail, not one horse like the next, each one a song. At one time, his old man must have wanted to be a real artist, one of those guys who hang their paintings in fancy galleries where rich people stroll, sipping wine and writing big checks. Maybe he wanted to be famous, Daniel doesn't know, because his father never talked, ever. It was like living with a very old man years before he got old. Could I have some ice? Daniel filled a spoon with crushed ice from the Dixie cup on the stand. He placed it on his mother's tongue, and she took it and pursed her lips and looked up at the ceiling, her eyes roving back and forth as if she were scanning a crowd. Outside her curtain window, there was bright sun, and a nurse laughed on the other side of the open door behind him. And maybe that's what made his mother turn back to him then. That laugh, a cool trickle down her throat, she and her long-dead husband riding the flying horses. I wanted to raise her, Danny. Don't think I didn't, because I did, honey. I know it, Ma, though he did not know it. He'd never seen this woman ever fight for anything, even a scrap of attention from his father. But right then wasn't the time for fighting. Daniel was 60 years old, sitting beside his mother's bed in that small room that smelled faintly of urine and cotton and old skin. He was 13 again, 14, 15, home from school for days because he could never lay so hotly inside him. He'd be kicked out once more, but his mother never scolded him, never yelled. She never told her husband either. Liam left for work before Danny was supposed to leave for school anyway, and she'd make her son pancakes or eggs and bacon, and she'd let him lie on the couch and read his comic books. The Avengers, Blue Beetle, though Enemy Ace was his favorite because the hero was a World War I German fighter pilot named Hans von Hammer, the Hammer of Hell, and he was misunderstood by everyone, but had a code of honor and never shot down an injured or helpless pilot. Sometimes his mother would sit beside Danny in her house coat, smelling like coffee, Ajax, and sweat, and she'd ask him to read her an episode, and he would. He could feel her watching him as he read, though, and when he turned to point out some action on the page, he'd catch her staring at him, a love in her eyes so deep it made him feel shy and like going to another room. But there was only his bedroom or the bathroom, and now, 45 years later, after all that had happened and all he had done, an oxygen tube hooked under his mother's nose, she turned her head on that hospital pillow and gave Daniel that same stare, her eyes so clear and steady with it that he had to look down at his hands. "Her last name is Dunn, Danny. That's all Lois would tell me." His mother-in-law, Lois, he still thinks of her that way. And not Dunn, but D-U-N-N, Dunn, right? Susan on his lap, her small ear pressed to his chest, his hand completely covering both her knees. "Why'd she tell you, Ma?" "Ice, honey." Her eyes were on the Dixie cup. Daniel took the spoon and scooped crushed ice on it, dripping cold water onto his mother's wrist, IV, sheet, and chin. Susan Dunn. Not Susan Lori Ahern, but Susan Dunn. 3 when he disappeared, 18 when he was paroled and not one visit from her. 40 years old, 3 years ago, as Daniel tilted the spoonful of crushed ice into his old mother's open mouth. "Did you tell her it was for me?" His mother swallowed and shook her head. Behind Daniel's eyes was a white sky. It was all you could see from the yard. No treetops, no telephone poles or wires, no roofs of buildings. Only the sky above the corner towers and 22-foot concrete walls and razor wire flashing in the sun. That patch of sky, it was cruel in its hint of how big and endless it really was. And it was cruel how slowly the next words from his mother were coming. "Where does she live, Ma?" "She wouldn't tell me." "Did you ask her?" His mother nodded. Her eyes were on the ceiling again, scanning back and forth, back and forth. The oxygen tubes in her nose looked crooked, and she seemed more tired than she'd been only a minute ago, as if that minute had been years. "What did she say, Ma?" Her breathing was shallow. Her breasts lay slack beneath the sheet, and Johnny, "Ma?" There was more laughter from her nurse, the beeping of a distant machine in a distant room, his mother's breathing. She did not go that day or the day after or even a week later. It may have been 3 weeks, and they had other talks, but never again about Daniel's and Linda's daughter, Susan. The morphine seemed to take his mother places she enjoyed, wolves in the snow who were friendly and covered her with branches to keep her warm. A gondola in Venice, Italy, a place his mother had never been, though now she was floating under stone bridges with Frank Sinatra when he was young and skinny. Then the gondola became a sleeper car on a train, and she talked a long time about farms and men with hands cracked from the sun and rain and wind. "Your father always worked so hard, Danny."
"I know, Ma. He was very talented."
"I know.
He used to brush my hair."
"Liam?
The moon, Danny. I always thought about it." Daniel can't remember the last thing she said to him, but it was not from the world he lived in. When she died, Daniel was driving to see her late on a Sunday morning in March. Dirty snow plowed up against the sidewalks. Nailed to the pine trunk just inches from his trailer's kitchen window is a rusted metal thermometer in the shade, 94 degrees. Daniel rinses his glass and sets it upside down on the drain board and steps back outside. His trailer's door is slightly warped and racked out of square, and he has to lift upward before the latch clicks into place. The sun is as high as it will get all day. There isn't a shadow in the center of his yard, and his half-caned chair looks raw and undressed. It's from the Victorian era, a time when everyone seemed to want to live like dukes and duchesses, and it's part of a set for an antiques dealer down in Port City. He's a pipe-smoking bull of a guy who told Daniel if these came out right, he'd trust him with a core reed rocker on a bent wood frame made just after the Civil War. Daniel had to go pick up the chairs in his truck, and he'd quoted the dealer $1.50 per caning hole for each seat,
which didn't include refinishing them first. This is a big money job that could lead to other big money jobs, so Daniel's bills are minimal. So what does he need the money for? Susan Dunn. With each passing day, week, and month, those two words his mother gave him are rising to the surface of his skin like something infected. Susan Dunn. She's living out there somewhere. He'll need a nest egg to find her, won't he? And maybe she needs money. Maybe he can give her that. The sun's too high now to keep working. Daniel carries the half-cane chair inside and sets it down alongside the others. His shop isn't much larger than a storage shed, and it smells like varnish and walnut dust and the galvanized metal of its roof flashing. Daniel swings the door shut and padlocks it. He's thinking of a cool shower, and he should eat something too, but he has no appetite, just that ache he can't quite get used to. And it's only as he's walking under the sun to his trailer does he know that this is the day. Whether he's needed at the Council on Aging this afternoon is the day he's going to walk into the town's library, sit at one of the computers, and type onto the dusty keyboard long ago, Susan Laurie, Susan Laurie Ahern. Thank you.
Thank you.